You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickard are off today. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll hear stories about the city of Milwaukee during World War II. First, the Supreme Court upheld Connecticut's ban on assault weapons this morning. The court decided it would not hear challenges from gun rights advocates to review weapons bans that were put in place after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. The decision came without comment from the court. It also came when emotions are high around the issue of gun control so soon after 49 people were killed by a man with an assault weapon at a gay nightclub in Orlando. Joining us now to tell us more about the Supreme Court's decision is Ryan Owens. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and the incoming director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure, you bet, Judith.
So a lower court decision said lawmakers were justified in banning assault weapons in Connecticut. Does the Supreme Court's refusal to hear the challenge to that decision basically say that it's all right for local lawmakers to ban weapons?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. People in the media often report on the court's decision not to hear a case as the court actually affirming that case or upholding the lower court's decision. And that is just technically wrong. The court, all it did today was say that it wasn't going to weigh in on this particular case and this particular controversy. So we really can't take much away from that other than to say that at this time, the court didn't see much of a justification to involve itself in the dispute.
So how often would you say does the court defer to state laws on Second Amendment, that is, gun rights related cases?
Well, it hasn't heard a decision on the Second Amendment since 2010, or at least it hasn't given us a sort of a full-throated decision since 2010. And before that, the most current one was in 2008. But those are the two big ones in recent years. It really hasn't gotten involved in the situation, the discussion over the Second Amendment for a very long time.
And what is behind that? Why have they been reluctant, perhaps is the word, to hear these types of cases?
Sure. Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. If we just take a look first at the cases before the court today, there were two cases that were consolidated together, and the court was deciding whether to hear them. In one of those cases, the petitioner was pro se, meaning he was representing himself. And the record in the case was just really it was just terrible factually, just a garbage record. So it's not surprising that the court didn't hear that one. The other one wasn't great either, but the court could have heard that. Now, why doesn't it get involved in these? Well, frankly, I think for a long time there really wasn't a push by, I suppose, predominantly the left to pass much gun control legislation. But I think you've seen that ramp up quite a bit in recent years. Certainly in the Clinton administration, there were some bills there that were advocated. But now I think if you take a look at social media and certainly the presidential primary for the Democrats, you see a lot of rhetoric about assault weapon bans and gun control. And it's something that has picked up steam, I think, in the national media lately. And so I wouldn't be surprised then if the court doesn't get more involved with it in the future.
Does this on some level come down to a states' rights argument that the court might be saying, we're not going to say how this really applies to the Second Amendment, but local jurisdiction does allow for different communities, states, cities to make that decision for themselves?
No, it doesn't. If you looked at the court's decision in 2010 on this, advocates of gun control legislation made that argument that, hey, this is about states' rights. And Justice Alito's opinion said, it's kind of rich that you're advocating for states' rights right now, when the states are trying to pass gun control legislation. But over the last 50, 60 years, when you were trying to expand federal rights in areas of criminal law and others, you were totally against states' rights. So I think that's more or less just it's just a positional argument that people are making who want to support the gun control position, and the court is not buying into it at all.
We're talking with Ryan Owens. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and the incoming director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision today to not hear some challenges to some local restrictions on assault rifles. So we are faced with a 4-4 court on many issues since the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. Is that playing any role in their decisions to take on cases like these or other cases around guns rights?
Yeah, I think it is. Just in general, the cases. I think we've seen the court relist a number of petitions, which is to say that they've put it off for their next conference. I think we've seen them relisting some more cases than they have in the past. And most people seem to think that's a consequence of the 8-person court. I think the justices are, you know, quite bright about these things, right? They recognize that they're likely to have an 8-person court at the beginning of the next court term, and so I suspect there are a number of cases that they are deciding not to hear that they otherwise might. Sure, I think that's definitely likely.
We know that the U.S. Supreme Court is supposed to be an apolitical body, but of course the justices are appointed by sitting presidents. Of course, they are part of the larger culture, as we all are. As mm-hmm. you said, there has been something of a change in politicians being willing to kind of touch that third rail of gun control in light of so many tragedies, Orlando being the most recent. Mm-hmm. Does that maybe, even if it's a very small shift right now, does that seeming shift in the sands on gun control influence the court at all?
It might. I mean, I certainly think that among the most recent two appointees to the court, there is a position that's maybe not particularly friendly to gun rights. Justice Sotomayor in particular, I think, is not predisposed in favor of them. What is interesting is Justice Kagan used to go hunting with Justice Scalia regularly. So I'm not sure that's going to sway her very much, but it is an interesting tidbit of information. Yeah, I mean, the notion that the court is apolitical is, of course, a farce. Anybody who sort of watches the court knows that justices do come to the court with their preferences, their predispositions. And we've certainly seen that play out in the court over the last few years, maybe more than in other recent terms. I mean, the court's liberal bloc has stuck together very, very tightly over the last 15 to 20 years. And the conservative bloc has not quite done that as well. Justice Kennedy sort of wavered back and forth, and so has Justice O'Connor. So it is interesting to see how the court is deciding a lot of these 8-person opinions. I'll be very interested to see what happens in the Texas immigration case and what happens in the affirmative action case.
There are a few legal concepts that are more ardently held in very different ways than the Second Amendment. People who are very pro-gun rights say that the Second Amendment is clear. We all have the right to bear arms and to protect ourselves. There are other people on the other side, on gun control advocate side, who will say clearly the founding fathers did not have any concept of the kind of assault rifles that are available now. There's no way that weapons like that fall under the Second Amendment. From a constitutional legal standpoint, how would you explain those two positions, and does one or the other hold more sway with you?
Well, so first off, I mean, my views on this, I suppose, are irrelevant. But if you look at, sort of the founding era debates, there is some ambiguity there as to whether or not the text of the Second Amendment generates an individual right, or whether it's something that was created just to keep, as it says, a well-ordered militia. It's, that ambiguity is there. It's hard to decide what is what. But I think, the court's analysis in the Heller case in 2008 was a pretty good historical overview of, founding era debates. And I think the court probably came down, it certainly came down in a position that is constitutionally justified. But as you say, I mean, there are people who oppose that position, and they do have some legal arguments to support them. this is one of those areas where the Constitution is somewhat ambiguous, although, as I said, I think the court's decision in Heller was probably right. And with that ambiguity, of course, comes conflict. And I think gun rights proponents often see arguments being made by gun control advocates as sort of being sort of missing the point, right? So after the Orlando shootings, everybody said we can't have these automatic weapons. We have to get rid of them. Well, it turns out that these didn't occur with automatic weapons, right? So I think a lot of people on that position for gun control, or excuse me, for gun rights, see the arguments made by gun control advocates and think, look, they're not telling the truth on this, and what they're trying to do is just push an agenda. And of course, you know, people on the left look at the NRA and think, you know, all they're doing is just sort of conspiring to scare members of Congress. So it's just an area of constitutional ambiguity that generates political controversy. You know, I think that the court's decision in Heller was a reasonably, reasonably designed opinion. But I don't see this argument going away anytime soon.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you.
That was Ryan Owens. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison and the incoming director of the Tommy Thompson Center on Public Leadership. He talked with us about the Supreme Court's refusal today to hear cases that challenge state bans on assault weapons. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk about the best books to dive into this summer with the co-founder of Goodreads. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Lots of people love their Harleys. Frank Latta loved his motorcycle so much that he took it with him to war aboard an American submarine during the Second World War. Writer Meg Jones tells us the story of the Harley that may still be at the bottom of the ocean.
Submarines are cramped, especially World War II subs. Not a lot of space for anything not absolutely necessary to operate the ship and keep the men inside alive. They're basically torpedoes where sailors skip showers, grew beards, and shared bunks with whoever worked the opposite watch. But what if I told you that at least one American submarine carried a Harley-Davidson motorcycle on board during the war? The submarine was the USS Lagarto, and it was built in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, where the shipworks in that city on Lake Michigan built 28 subs during World War II. Of the millions of Americans who enlisted in the military after Pearl Harbor, I'd like to think quite a few were gearheads who reluctantly left their motorcycles at home as they shipped out to boot camp. Not Frank Latta. He actually figured out a way to bring his wheels with him. Latta was the captain of the USS Lagarto. He moved his wife and two young sons to Manitowoc in 1944 as shipyard workers finished building the submarine. At the ship's launching ceremony, the submarine slid sideways into the water, throwing up a huge wave that drenched many of the onlookers. No one living today knows exactly when or where Latta bought his Harley, but the only photo of the submarine captain astride his beloved hog shows what is believed to be a 1942 EL or FL model. The picture was likely taken in Hawaii. By the time Latta was assigned to the Lagarto, he was a veteran of 9 war patrols and had earned a Navy Cross, the second highest medal for valor. Before shipping out on the Lagarto, Latta and his machinist mate disassembled the Harley, lowered the pieces into the narrow opening, and stashed them wherever they could find room inside the submarine. When the Lagarto reached port and Latta had some free time, he assembled the pieces and roared off to see the sights. The Lagarto sunk a Japanese submarine and a cargo vessel on its first war patrol in February 1945. The last anyone heard of the Lagarto was in early May off the coast of Thailand. It didn't make radio contact. It didn't return to port. Within a few weeks, telegrams began to arrive at the homes of the 86 men on board, including Latta. The men were listed as missing in action. A year later, they were officially declared dead. Their families could bury no bodies, and they wouldn't know what happened until 6 decades later, when scuba divers found the shipwreck in 150 feet of water. The Lagarto was upright, and one of its outer torpedo doors was open. The rudder was turned hard to port, and its dive plane set for a fast dive. That probably meant Latta had fired torpedoes at an enemy ship and then tried to flee a depth charge attack. But the Lagarto didn't survive. In 2005, scuba divers reported seeing what looked like a huge hole punched in the side of the submarine. No hatches were open. That means the 86 men are most likely entombed in the USS Lagarto. Frank Latta's Harley is probably inside as well.
Meg Jones is a journalist and the author of World War II Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and find us on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
And we're joined now by the author we just heard from, Meg Jones. Her book, World War II Milwaukee, explores the stories of Milwaukee during that time period through interviews and archival research. Meg, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So how would you describe the general feeling and atmosphere in Milwaukee during World War II?
Well, it was very much a city that was hard at work. So Milwaukee, at the time of the Pearl Harbor attack, was known as the machine shop of the world. So there were lots of industry businesses, a very highly trained workforce that very quickly switched from a civilian to a military business standpoint. So at the time, it was pretty much everybody that could work in the factories was working in the factories or was working to support the workers that were in the factories and to support those Milwaukeeans who had enlisted and were drafted into the war.
I grew up in Chicago, and I heard a lot of stories from older generations in my family about how, you know, my aunt was a block captain for the blackout tests to close off all the windows and make sure there was no light showing and people building and producing gardens and things like that. Was there that similar kind of sense of we're all in this together?
Oh, exactly. It was very much, you know, it was kind of like the last time that all of America kind of pulled together for one effort, because you really didn't have it with Korea or Vietnam or the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars. It was really the last time that pretty much everybody knew somebody that was in the military or had a close family member or a neighbor, and you could go down pretty much any neighborhood of any street in Milwaukee and see the flags with the blue stars in the windows, which signified that a family member was serving overseas in the military, or sadly you could also see the gold star banners, which meant that a loved one had been killed in action.
So let's dig deeper into some of the stories you talk about in your book. Can you tell us about Milwaukee Mayor Carl Zeidler?
Yeah, so what's interesting about Carl Zeidler is at the time Milwaukee was one of the largest cities in the U.S., and being the mayor of one of those large cities in wartime was a very important job. But Carl, who was in his early 30s at the time, decided to, he did not want to stay home. He decided to join and enlist in the Naval Reserve. And Carl was assigned to a merchant marine ship, and it was Carl's very poor luck to be in the Merchant Marine in 1942, and that was a time when the German U-boats, the Wolfpack, basically ruled the seas. So there's hundreds of millions of tons of Allied shipping that was sunk by the German U-boats, and sadly, Carl's was one of those ships. He had been kind of had a meteoric rise here in Milwaukee. He had never been elected to public office before he decided to run for mayor and take on a very popular mayor, Daniel Hone, and he won and was very charismatic, blonde, blue-eyed, very handsome, had a great baritone, would sing at pretty much every function. All the women would swoon over him. In fact, when I was doing research on the chapter about Carl, I met some women who remembered him, and they were swooning still, even all these decades later. So Carl was assigned to a ship, a merchant marine ship, that left Cuba in the fall of 1942 on its way to Pakistan with munitions and airplane parts, and it never arrived. So he was one of the many, many people that was declared missing in action, and nobody ever knew what happened to him until many, many years later. But his younger brother, Frank, who became the longtime mayor of Milwaukee in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, he always wanted to know what had happened to his beloved older brother, and it was through Frank's efforts to track down the, and he basically was able to track down the location of like the coordinates of his brother's ship's last sighting, and then from there, then he was able to determine which U-boat it was, and he was there, he was able to track down the German U-boat captain's log, and in very heart-wrenching detail, he learned the last moments of Frank Seidler.
So I was surprised to learn that there was actually a thriving Nazi movement in Milwaukee. Why Milwaukee?
Yeah, so I was surprised about that as well, too. I mean, I grew up here in Milwaukee, and I consider myself a native, and I had no idea. But and there were a lot of German American societies that were in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin at the time, which isn't a surprise because a very large percentage of Wisconsinites and Milwaukeeans in particular were either German immigrants or they were first or second generation of German immigrants. So there were a lot of societies that were very benign music societies, that sort of thing. But there was also something called the Volksbund. And the Volksbund was a very pro-Nazi movement, and in the 1930s, there was a very thriving chapter of a Volksbund chapter right here in Milwaukee, and they would meet at the Milwaukee Auditorium and other places and have rallies and would dress up in the brown shirt uniforms and fly the Nazi swastika flags. And I was reading some newspapers from the time, and quite often those rallies would end in violence because local communists or protesters would protest the movement. But interestingly enough, the leader of the Milwaukee Volksbund was a man by the name of George Frobos. And toward the start of the war, a lot of the Volksbund chapter presidents and leaders across the U.S. were either indicted or were called to testify or were deported. And eventually George, the Milwaukee head of the Volksbund, became the national leader of the Volksbund. And just a year before, so this is in 1941, and just a year before, there was a huge rally in Madison Square Garden that drew like 25,000 people, all Volksbund supporters. Now, this is at a time when the Nazis, the Germans, are already engaged in World War One, and they and so George was became the leader. And about 6 months later, he was subpoenaed to testify in a grand jury out in New York.
I'm sorry, Meg, but we're going to have to leave it there. Really interesting stuff. Meg Jones is a reporter for the Wisconsin Journal Sentinel and the author of World War II Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Reveal. Last week's attack on a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, was the largest mass shooting in modern American history. Reveal goes to Orlando to hear from survivors and learn how the FBI investigates potential terrorists. They also explore how security companies screen potential employees, such as the nightclub shooter. That's tonight at 7, here on the Ideas Network. First, summer means that some of us are planning getaways to the beach or more exotic locations, and some of us are planning more low-key staycations. Either way, it's a time of year when most of us will finally get a chance to read something other than emails, homework, or maybe memos from your boss. So we thought it would be a good time to get some summer reading ideas. Our next guest will give us suggestions, but we want to get some from you as well. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what books you're planning on picking up and why. Do you like to turn to new releases over the summer, or is there a classic that you find yourself going back to every year? Call us at 800-642-1234. Joining us now is Elizabeth Khoury Chandel. She's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Goodreads, the world's largest site for readers and book recommendations. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Thanks for joining us. So tell us, what tends to make a good read specifically for the summer?
Well, I think it really depends on what kind of reader you are. What makes a good book or what kind of... Can you repeat the question?
Sure. What makes a good summer read? Are people looking for something a little lighter or something that's short and easy to read, maybe on a plane or in a car or in a hotel room?
Yeah, no, I think it really depends on what kind of reader you are. I know some people want a great plot-driven novel, you know, a thriller or something, a really fun horror book. Others want a meaty book because they finally have time to sit down and really absorb something, and maybe that's a book by a literary author or just a book with a really complex, intense story. Other people want, you know, to escape and relax, and they're looking for, you know, maybe even the reality TV version of a book. And something else that I think people want in the summer that I've always enjoyed is if I get to travel somewhere. For example, I went to Africa once, and I brought with me a bunch of books that took place in that country, and I read things like Reason for Hope by Jane Goodall, and it really added a great layer to my experience when I was traveling, an extra set of context.
So I'm thinking about summer movies, and they're often like the fun romantic comedies or like big action movies kind of thing. Do you see any parallels to the kind of books that tend to get popular in the summer?
I mean, definitely in certain genres. For example, there's a book called The Fireman by Joe Hill that is really popular right now among our readers. It has a 4.15 average rating, and it's a horror book. And I don't know if you know who Joe Hill is.
I don't, no.
He also happens to be Stephen King's son.
Oh.
And he also writes horror, but under a pen name. And it's a book about a plague that is crossing the country called Dragon Scale, and it marks the hosts with these crazy marks across their bodies, and then they spontaneously burst into flames. And there's no anecdote. And the story follows a pregnant nurse who catches it and wants to carry the baby to term. And she meets a man called the Fireman, and he takes her to a special camp where they know how to control the fires. And, you know, it has sort of that big movie feel to it, and the pace is just amazing.
Well, let me have you stop there for just a second, because I want to bring a listener into the conversation. Jeff in Onalaska has something that I think fits in well. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi. What do you recommend?
I just picked up the third book in the Bill Hodges trilogy by Stephen King. It's called End of Watch, but the first one is Mr. Mercedes. I really enjoy this series. It's a crime fiction series, which is not typically King's genre, but he does a really good job with it, and it's just really, you know, fast paced and something that you can definitely bring to the beach and just read through quickly.
Nice. So it's the latest Stephen King trilogy, the Bill Hodges trilogy. So he's writing more of a detective kind of thing, whereas his son is writing the horror. So maybe they feel like they have to split up the duties. So what, Jeff, would you say makes it particularly good for a beach read?
You know, just the how fast paced it is, where, you know, you just kind of want to keep going with it. And it's also not too long, and you know, I think it's somewhere about 350, close to 400 pages, which I guess maybe could be long for some, but not compared to some of the other King novels.
I was going to say, for Stephen King, that's practically a short story. Well, thanks for that call. And Elizabeth, have you read those books, first of all?
You know, I read some of Stephen King. I haven't read that trilogy, but I've certainly heard of it. There is another mystery thriller book that I know is getting a lot of buzz on our site. We have, you know, 1.5 billion books added to our site, so we get some really great data. I don't know if you've heard of Redemption Road by John Hart. It's a suspense novel set in North Carolina about a girl who's kidnapped and a boy who wants revenge for his mother's death, set in a small town on the brink of chaos, that's also just getting rave reviews from our members. They think the characters are super memorable and complex.
We're visiting with Elizabeth Khoury Chandler, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Goodreads. We're talking about great summer books to recommend or to get an idea of what you might want to read when you're maybe heading to the beach or just relaxing in your own backyard. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1061. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you reading any books right now that you'd like to recommend? Or maybe you're struggling to find that perfect summer read for this year that fits your tastes. Maybe Elizabeth or one of our listeners can give you a suggestion. Call in at 800-642-1234. Well, I will say, Elizabeth, one of my favorite genres is historical fiction. I really like a book that does a really good job of painting that particular place and time. And I really especially like when you can't really tell which characters are the real historical ones and the ones that have been created for that story because they're so well woven together. Are there any books in the historical fiction area that are getting a lot of attention right now?
You know, we have tons in historical fiction. That's a really popular genre on the site. And the one that I would recommend at the top of my list is a book that just sucked me in. It's called Lilac Girls, and it's by a woman named Martha Hall Kelly. And it takes place during World War II. It's about three different women and actually based on real people. It's about a New York socialite Broadway actress debutante in New York City who is very involved in the French cause, and a Polish teenager who's part of the underground resistance, and a German doctor. And these three women's lives get intertwined when the Polish teenager is sent to Ravensbrück, which is a concentration camp in Germany that was all female and known for being a place where they conducted medical experiments on the prisoners. And readers are calling it this year's Nightingale, saying things like, "I will remember these women." Powerful, extremely engrossing. I have had trouble putting it down. It's just so vivid, and it really paints a picture of World War II from a woman's perspective, and also just brings together three very, very different points of view. It's a really incredible book.
And that actually reminds me of a book that I did not read as a summer title, but that I think could really be very satisfying that way, All the Light We Cannot See, which also is during World War II, and it follows two parallel stories of a young girl in Paris and then a young boy in Germany, and how their stories develop in this very tumultuous and difficult time, and how their stories start to arc towards each other. And I have to say, it's, you know, for me, summer doesn't necessarily mean light. It means engaging and engrossing and something that feels fun to read, like a treat to read. And that book particularly switches between the two stories. They're only, I'd say, maybe 5 to 10 pages at a time of one story, and then it switches to the other. So it's also good if you want something you can kind of put down and pick back up again as you have the time.
Exactly. And this book is very similar. You have a chapter in New York, and then you're in Germany, and you move back and forth, and you can sort of pace yourself when things get to be a little bit tough, but it still just keeps dragging you back in.
Let's go back to the phones, and Austin joins us in Madison. Hi, Austin.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to recommend a couple books. On the topic of historical fiction, I didn't plan on it, but I really enjoyed Cryptonymicon about World War II, and it includes Alan Turing as a character.
Oh, interesting.
But I'd also, the ones I called in about, and I think these are great summer books because they're lighter, they're shorter, but they're still very engaging. They are Watership Down, which has a very strong biological backbone of knowledge to it, written by a biologist. And the other is The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin, which is a fantastic sci-fi book.
Okay, so Left Hand of Darkness is Ursula Le Guin, and she's certainly kind of an icon in the fantasy world. What is that particular book about, The Left Hand of Darkness?
It's kind of a sci-fi fantasy set on a world that's very cold, and not only the temperature, but the political climate's very cold. And it's kind of an adventure novel. It's just fantastic. It's one of my favorite books.
And Watership Down, I would say I have read that. And in fact, Austin, you'll appreciate that I had a cat named Bigwig several years ago, named after one of the characters in Watership Down. I would say it's one of the most human books, and yet the characters are all rabbits.
Yes. And the author was an actual, he was a biologist who was working during World War II passing messages, but mostly just sitting on an island alone with a number of rabbits bored, so he was studying them. And he really bases how the rabbits behave, aside from their communication, I guess, on actual facts about rabbit biology.
Well, thanks for that call, Austin. And is that something that you hear often, Elizabeth, that sometimes people want to go back to books that they have a really strong emotional draw to?
Absolutely. One of the most requested features on our site is the option to reread a book. People love to go back to books that they've read before. Yes.
And actually, Malcolm Brett, who's the head of Wisconsin Public Radio and Television, the Broadcast and Media Innovations branch, he said his go-to books for the summer are a reread of at least one Raymond Chandler novel and one Dashiell Hammett novel. And he says he also intermittently during the summer will reread Jack Kerouac's On the Road. So some really good classics there. We are talking with Elizabeth Khoury Chandler, co-founder and editor editor-in-chief of Goodreads, and we're talking about summer reading recommendations, whether you're looking for a book to read on the beach or in your downtime away from work. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What genres do you like reading for pleasure? Are there any books you're reading now that you'd like to recommend? Are you still struggling to find that perfect summer read this year that fits your tastes? Maybe Elizabeth or our other listeners can give you a suggestion. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll be back with this conversation after a short break here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Elizabeth Khoury Chandler, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Goodreads. We're talking about the best books to pick up this summer, and we want to hear from you. What do you look for in a great summer read? What's the most memorable book you've ever read while traveling or on vacation? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Give us your summer reading recommendations or ask Elizabeth for a suggestion. Our number again is 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones, and Chris in Madison is up. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you have for us?
So I actually got introduced to a topical series that's printed out of Oxford University Press called A Very Short Introduction. And I did this for my capstone course, but it's just about a 200-page small book that looks like about the size of your hand, about that big, and it's on every single subject you can think of, from Aristotle to magic to that.
Huh.
You just find which subject you want to read about or learn a little bit more about, and you kind of eases you into it. It's very user-friendly.
Wow. So it's, I mean, there are the, like, whatever for dummies, but that's more of like a how-to. This sounds like a very capsulized nonfiction mm-hmm. book about all kinds of things. What have been some of your favorites?
So I really enjoyed reading the one about Hegel. There was also one about love and like the history of love, which is really interesting, but how different societies have kind of looked at it and incorporated into theirs and how we look at it now. And so it's pretty interesting to read on anything from modern China to like madness.
That pretty much covers the spectrum. Well, that's really interesting. I haven't heard of that, Chris, and I'm definitely going to look that up. Elizabeth, have you heard about a Very Short Introduction to series?
Not very deeply, no. I haven't read them either. I wish I had read all the books that are on our site, but no, I'm always humbled by that.
Well, Eric in Kenosha is up next, and he is hoping you can help him out. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Well, yes, I'm hoping you can help me. I'm a big fan of sci-fi fantasy, and I am desperately looking for something to keep me occupied while George R.R. Martin rediscovers the typewriter. We just, you know, for those of us who are fans of those books, we're just, you know, we're dying here. You know, he left us hanging years, and so, you know, what else is there? What can you recommend?
And for those who aren't familiar with him, Eric, what has he written?
He wrote the whole series of books that are the basis, well, I don't want to say the basis for the Game of Thrones series on HBO. So it's there's a song, I think the whole collection is called The Song of Fire and Ice, but they're all of the titles are a something of something.
Okay. So Game of Thrones type books. Elizabeth, is anything jumping to mind?
You know, Game of Thrones, I watch the series. I'm not a huge expert on the sci-fi fantasy genre. I mentioned the one that we talked about, the Joe Hill. Another one that could be good, though, that is worth checking out is Sleeping Giants by Sylvain Nouvel. Hmm. It's like a buzzy book in the style of The Martian. Hmm. It's World War Z meets The Martian, is what readers are saying. And a physician named Rose tries to crack a code that will unlock an instrument of peace or destruction. That would probably be my top recommendation.
All right. Well, Eric, we hope that gets you through. Maybe read slowly so you pace yourself. let's go back to the phone since we've got a lot of people wanting to join the conversation. Ginny in Middleton is up. Hi, Ginny.
Hi.
Hi. What do you have?
My favorite light reading is the Stephanie Plum series by Janet Ivanovich.
And what's that series about?
Stephanie Plum is a bail bondsman, and it's about her adventures and misadventures, and it's just a lot of fun reading, and there's a whole bunch of them in the series.
Oh, okay. So that's one thing I have to say I really like, Elizabeth. I like when I get really into a book and enjoy the characters, and I don't have to say goodbye to them at the end. I really like to, even if it takes a while, even if there's the break between books as the author frantically writes the next one, I like knowing that there's going to be another one.
That's amazing. We actually had Janet come into our office in the early years of Goodreads, and she's just a really cool, spunky author that we love. You know, there's definitely writers like Leanne Moriarty that are really popular and light, that readers just go crazy for. I know she has a new book coming out right now called Truly Madly Guilty that's coming out at the end of July about six adults and three kids who go to a barbecue and something happens. But it touches on everything from like IVF to hoarding to an upcoming cello audition. And I just think authors like Leanne have a knack of taking and exaggerating human foibles to put together amazing stories.
I have to say, one of the series that I read recently and that also I think would be a good lighter or quicker read is the series Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. And it's actually a young adult, or I'm never sure what the precise ages are, but it's definitely for slightly younger than adult readers, but there's so much in it for adults, and it makes really amazing use of archival photos to build the story around. And I would really recommend those three books. I hope that there's going to be another one someday. I'm just choosing to believe that, but I found myself really sucked in by those. Let's go back to the phones, and we have Gary in Racine up next. Hi, Gary.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to recommend Dead Wake by Eric Larson.
Dead Weight.
It's about the sinking of the Lusitania in World War I.
Oh, okay.
And it was excellent. It took me less than a week to read it because once you started, you couldn't put it down.
Hmm.
And gave me a whole different perspective on World War I, President Wilson, and the fact that the United States did not enter the war because of the sinking of the Lusitania. We didn't enter the war for 2 years after that event.
Oh, interesting. So it shed some light on something that we thought was kind of a history truism.
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you so much for recommending that. And is that the same Eric Larson who wrote Devil in the White City?
Yes. And he also wrote the one about Garden of the Beast, the one about the ambassador to Nazi Germany in World War II.
Right, which I've read that one as well. Very nice writing. Well, thanks for that, Gary. And Lucas sent in an email to help out our listener who was looking for something like Game of Thrones. He recommends the Wretched of Muirwood, Muirwood series for that. Well, Elizabeth, so much to talk about and so little time. We really appreciate you spending time with us today, and I hope you get a lot of reading time in the summer.
Thanks so much for having me.
Elizabeth Khoury Chandler is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Goodreads. She joined us with some book recommendations for summer vacation. You can continue with your ideas on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.